Well, hello, and welcome to the Psychotronic Film Society, the podcast.
You want to start over?
I don't know. No, that was fine. The podcast celebrating the best cult, horror, sci-fi, and action films, and it's the home of the Psychotronic Hall of Fame, which is a growing collection of the greatest genre films of all time, as decided by you, our very special listeners. I'm your co-host, Gary Horn.
I'm co-host, Justin Bishop. Hey, Gary.
Hey, we're here to record a podcast.
Yeah,
They're not even sure it is a podcast, Justin.
This week, we're doing an actual normal show, unlike that shit show last week. We apologize again for not having the All Monsters Attack episode. I might put it out in some raw, unedited, shitty-sounding form at some point, but I haven't decided yet. And we apologize again to Brian, who came on and gave a really great conversation and made a really great case for redeeming the film. Just unfortunately, the audio wasn't up to our normal standards, so we released an older episode of our old podcast, which also, ironically, had kind of shitty audio.
I thought of that, too, as I was editing.
But it was better than the All Monsters Attack one.
Yeah.
Like, it was listenable. Like, our recording on that one was, you can barely listen to it for 30 seconds without wanting to pull your ears off of your head.
And it's really kind of a bummer, because I went into that Godzilla film wanting to hate it. And as I recalled, my least favorite one.
Yeah, but we had a lot of fun with that episode and a lot of fun with Brian. So we're going to get our shit together and figure out this remote recording thing. I've been talking to several other podcasters who have done this successfully, and I feel like we're not that stupid that we should be able to figure this shit out, but I think we've been possibly making it more difficult than it needs to be. So we're going to get that worked out, and then we're going to be able to have guests that don't just know where you live.
Yeah. I'd prefer most of the guests don't know where I live.
Yeah.
So, but
this week, we need to address, first we need to address our movie from last week. We talked about Jaws.
It's both of our favorite movies.
I mean, we didn't talk about Jaws last week. We talked about it last July. We presented it to you last week and wanted to still give Jaws a chance to get into the Psychotronic Hall of Fame, because it's Jaws, man. It needs to, it deserves a spot, right?
Yeah, we didn't just feel like we needed to record a whole new episode. It'd just be beating a dead horse, because some of you hopefully have...
Or a dead shark.
Hey, Justin, what did our listeners think about Jaws?
Believe it or not, Gary, Jaws has been voted into the Psychotronic Hall of Fame.
I would hope so. I think we're going to need a bigger podcast. Oh, God.
Jesus.
Somebody kill me.
Yeah.
Don't do that. I know this goes out nationally, and I don't...
Please don't actually kill Gary.
Yeah, I don't want to die.
Well, that was last week. This is this week, and we're doing something vastly different than Jaws.
Well, you say that, but there's a lot of similarities that I will get
in. Well, in that they're both films, and both have people in them.
Both have directors that are well-known.
Yep, and both came out in the 70s.
Yeah,
okay. The one we're talking about this week just celebrated its 40th anniversary. Now, it officially premiered in March of 1977, March 19th specifically, at the Filmex Film Festival in Los Angeles. That wasn't a big premiere for it. This movie never had a big premiere. It never had an official, like, movie trailer that was going out. This is as underground a film as we've talked about on this show so far.
How do you think the trailer would have gone for this film?
I have no idea.
Yeah.
I don't know how you would sell this film. Anyway, the film we're talking about is David Lynch's Eraserhead.
You got your good things.
I'll get into why I nominated this film, but I don't think there are as there are very few films that encompass what a psychotronic film is more than Eraserhead. And we wanted to talk about it not only because it's just celebrated its big 40th anniversary, but also because David Lynch is back for the first time since Inland Empire, which was, 2005 or so. First time he's been behind the camera with the new Twin Peaks series coming out in a few weeks. So what better time to finally get some David Lynch into the Psychotronic Hall of Fame?
Yeah, and one thing he's great at is he makes me drink, which is the first time this has happened in a little while on the show. So, Justin, you can explain why I'm drinking.
I don't know if I can. I don't know if I can explain why you're drinking. I think maybe you just needed some sort of coping mechanism.
It's a lot to take in. I hope that...
That's what your mom said.
She sure did.
It's been a... You know, I know that I had seen this movie before. I remember somebody telling me to watch this movie back when I was in, like, high school.
Okay.
And they were like, turn off all the lights.
Yeah.
And just sit back.
Just let it wash over you.
Yeah, just take it in, man.
It's also what your mom said.
Oh, you know what? It was my mom that was telling me.
Your mom recommended to raise her head to you.
She sure did.
Well,
no, it was just, oddly enough, another name for my dick. I feel like this is...
We're off to a bad start.
We're off to a bad start, and we're mildly implying incest, and I don't like that at all.
Well, let's move on then.
Sorry, Mom. I love you, but I don't think of you that way.
Well, this is a... I feel like Eraserhead is one of those sort of... It's like a gateway drug to cult films. Like, for a lot of people... I know it, you know, upon its release, which I will get into, I'm going to get into some of the film's history here in a moment, but it was one of these midnight films, these midnight movies, one of the seminal midnight movies that really introduced the world to David Lynch. Really, for a lot of people, because it is a more well-known now cult film, I feel like a lot of people can watch this film and then they want to learn more about David Lynch or more about underground cinema or experimental cinema and things like that. And I feel like a big part of that is because that unlike a lot of other what you would consider art films or experimental films, this one's a little more accessible, which is a weird thing to say about this movie.
It sure is.
Because it is fucking weird.
It's really, really weird. See, I think people know what this movie is, but I think that most people, like even me, before I watched it again this time, I mean, I knew what it was. Just because of the image of...
That image of Henry is iconic.
Yeah.
It has become very iconic.
Yeah. So I think most people would know what you're talking about when you say Eraserhead just because of that image.
But haven't necessarily actually experienced the film.
Right.
My first experience with the movie was in college. I think I want to say it was my first year, maybe my second year of college. I was an art student. And I was in an art a design class. And I had this really cool teacher who showed us films on occasion. He introduced me to a film called Koyaanisqatsi that I'm a big fan of that maybe we will talk about on the show one day. But we took a field trip down. I think we were driving down to Atlanta to go to the High Museum. And at the time, it had to be my first year because the film had not yet been released on DVD ever. My teacher had a bootleg VHS copy of it from Japan that he played on the TVs that are in those big charter buses, you know. So that was my first experience with Eraserhead and with David Lynch, was sitting on a bus watching it on VHS with Japanese subtitles. I honestly did not know it was a Japanese bootleg and that the director was just being odd by putting Japanese subtitles on it.
It's funny you tell me that because I was looking around on YouTube actually before I rented the movie last night when I watched it. On YouTube, there was a version you could watch and it had Japanese subtitles.
Oh, yeah. That's probably from the same. That was probably just a widely circulated bootleg. So let's talk a little bit about the background of the film, because this movie has a really drawn out production history. It started out, so David Lynch did not set out to be a filmmaker. He was an artist. He was a painter, occasionally a sculptor. He wasn't, and he'll tell you in interviews, like he didn't grow up as a film buff. You hear stories about guys like Spielberg and even, you know, Stanley Kubrick and guys. They grew up going to the movies all the time. Like Martin Scorsese will tell you about, that's all he did as a kid. David Lynch didn't grow up going to movies. It wasn't his thing. That's not why he got into filmmaking. He got into filmmaking as an extension of his painting career. He had created several short films, and if you have the Criterion Blu-ray of this of Eraserhead, several of these short films are actually included as special features. He did one called Six Men Getting Sick. It was basically a projected film on like a sculpted screen that apparently included like little like sculptures of busts of faces and stuff like that. And it's just this like almost like a stop motion animation of these disembodied heads like throwing up all these weird colors. And it's played on a loop with a siren. It's really bizarre, but really super cool.
It's really weird that, like, clearly already he was on a different level.
Oh, yeah. And that's apparent in all of those short films. He did one called The Alphabet that's more of a traditional short film in that it has actors and stuff in it. But it's still, and it includes a lot of animated sequences. And even some of the live action stuff is stop motion animated. Mm-hmm. So it's just like, it's an actual person. It's not like a typical stop motion animation where you're animating figures, but it's got a very bizarre quality to it. And that was, he was doing this stuff in the 60s, and by 1970 he had decided to switch over to filmmaking completely.
It's super weird. When I was growing up, I liked to consider myself an artist, but I never thought that I would become a filmmaker. I drew, like, called it GGB. It was like gorillas, Godzilla, and boobs.
Okay.
I would draw those things. And on a good day,
I still draw all of those things.
Yeah. And on a good day, like, they would combine and it'd be like King Kong fighting Godzilla. But when I would draw King Kong, I always drew like round boobs. Yeah. And I remember doing that in like second grade and the teacher being like, "Are you drawing a naked woman?"
No, it's a gorilla.
It's a gorilla. And you got away with it. Also, dicks. I drew dicks. So it was like GGBD. Gorillas, Godzilla, boobs, and dicks.
All right. Did Godzilla just have a big swinging dick?
Anyway, I never thought about animating him, and I'm glad that no one ever did.
But you could have had a completely different career path, Gary.
I could have.
So at the age of 24, David Lynch was given a scholarship to the American Film Institute's Center for Advanced Film Studies. Which was kind of a big deal. The AFI was based in Washington, D.C. at the time, but the Center for Advanced Film Studies was based in Los Angeles, so he moved out to Los Angeles. AFI's location out there was like in a mansion, like this big sprawling mansion that they basically had the entire grounds for filmmaking. So David Lynch is working out there, begins to work on a script called Garden Back. The idea came from a painting that David Lynch had done. The painting was a hunched over figure with vegetation growing from his back. So he decided he's going to make this into a short film. And it was sort of a surreal film, probably in the vein of something like The Alphabet that he had done before, about adultery, which a hunched over figure had this insect growing inside of him that was sort of supposed to represent his growing lust for his neighbor. Honestly, we'll get into it, but it's going to share some of the same themes with Eraserhead, probably.
David Lynch is not a drug user, from my understanding.
No,
right?
No, he smokes cigarettes and drinks a lot of coffee. He apparently doesn't drink alcohol anymore, and he stopped drinking, smoking, and eating meat after making Eraserhead. He has since taken up smoking. I watched a documentary on the Eraserhead Blu-ray where he chain smokes for an hour and a half straight.
Nice.
So, the script for Garden Back would have resulted in about a 45-minute film. AFI thought that was too long for such a weird, nonlinear story. They wanted him to cut it down or, you know, change it somehow. He ended up seeing a guy at Fox who wanted him to make the movie for him. He's like, "I'll give you $50,000 to make this, but we want to make it feature length if we do that, which means you need a 115-page script."
Which is a pretty good deal for such a weird fucking idea.
Yeah, 50 grand?
Yeah,
it is weird.
To hand you
like, what the
grand.
Fuck was Fox going to do with that? So David Lynch started trying to think of how he was going to turn this into a full-size script. He went to his teacher, Frank Danielle, which was a teacher there at the AFI, who was kind of a mentor of his. Frank Danielle started telling him, you know, maybe the characters don't really talk in your film. Give them some dialogue. David Lynch was like, "What are they going to talk about?" Like, I don't understand. Like, he just didn't think of film that way. And honestly, even through Eraserhead, there's very little dialogue.
Right.
So he ended up getting a script written. There was a guy named Gil Dennis who was also they called their students fellows at the AFI. So it was another fellow there at the school who specialized in writing, and they came up with the script, and David Lynch just says, "You know, this is not what I intended it to be. Like, all the stuff that I like about my script is still there, but there's all this other shit in between that I just do not care about, and it's become something else." His exact quote, he says, "I knew I'd watered it down. It had just become more normal to me." So it wasn't like the vision that he originally had. So he got,
can't have that.
He got frustrated and stormed out. He came in and yelled at Frank Danielle, his mentor, said, "I quit," stormed out and left. Goes home, and his wife Peggy at the time says, "Oh, what's going on? Like, they've been calling us every 10 minutes. What did you do?" And he's like, "Oh, well, I quit." And she's like, "They just want you to come in, come talk to them." So he goes in. Frank tells him He's like, we must have done something wrong because you're one of our favorite people here and we've clearly upset you. What can we do to make it right? David Lynch says, well, I don't want to do this piece of shit garden back now. It's ruined. I want to make a Eraserhead, because he already had the idea for a Eraserhead in his head. So they're like feeling guilty and bad about making him upset because they liked him so much that they're like, all right, just do a Eraserhead. Do whatever you want.
What do you fucking think was going on over there? They just thought, like, this is the next auteur.
Well,
like,
they were not really a feature filmmaking place. Like, they were more into... In fact, there was at a certain point during the filming of Eraserhead, they actually completely discontinued any feature films. They did not allow them to be made. So they were more into, like, experimental filmmaking and sort of underground outsider stuff, which is weird if you think about what the American Film Institute is now, which is huge. But at the time, that's kind of what they were wanting to do. They were wanting to bring in the more artistic side of filmmakers. This is the early 70s. You know, this is when independent filmmaking, like things like Easy Rider, were coming out. And these outsider filmmakers were sort of doing their own thing outside of the studio and coming up with really cool stuff, you know.
Right.
So David Lynch has a script for Eraserhead. It's 22 minutes or 22 pages long. Now, in normal filmmaking... that equals 22 minutes of film. Typically, one page of script is 1 minute of film. So they're like, so you're going to make a 22-minute film? He's like, no, it's probably going to be a little bit longer than that. He ends up going to the stables at AFI, the stables on the grounds of this mansion, and sort of that's where he set up shop. So he had these stables. There were like maids' quarters and butler's quarters on top, and they had all these different rooms that they could turn into editing suites and a food room and a, you know, even sets and things like that. Kind of took it over and basically had it to himself. And over time, they sort of forgot he was out there, and he's just off doing his thing this whole time. The film was made over... 5 year period of time, which is sort of insane. And the reason it was is because they kept running out of money. AFI at a certain point had given them all the money that they're going to give them, and they had would have to stop filming and come up with money to continue. Jack Fisk, who was the guy in the film who played the man in the window at the beginning, was a pretty successful art director at this point, working for guys like William Friedkin. He would go on, like he did The Revenant most recently. He's an award-winning production designer. And his then-girlfriend, later wife, was Sissy Spacek, who was already an established actress at this point. And they helped out in the film. So there were certain points where they would run out of money while filming this. And Jack Fisk, who was doing all this work for William Friedkin, would go, and he was getting like 3 different paychecks at a time. He'd take David Lynch to the bank with him, write the paycheck over to him, and say, here, go make your movie. He had friends who were just giving him money. Jack Nance, who got cast as Henry, our lead character, his wife at the time was Catherine Coulson, who signed on because her husband was in it, but then she ended up learning how to be a camera operator. She's actually technically credited as assistant director, but she held the boom mic. She learned how to do the camera. Like she was kind of on the set all the time.
It seems like fake that this movie even happened.
It's really incredible how many people were behind David Lynch, this unknown filmmaker, like this bizarre, weird vision that he had. And like they wanted him to get it done. Like they believed in him enough to like literally give him their money. Catherine Coulson she was a waitress during the day. They filmed all night. She'd waitress all during the day, come to set, give him all of her tips that she made that day so that he could keep making the film and then help him film all night. I don't know when the fuck she went to sleep because she was doing this on and on for 4 years.
That's insane. And poor Jack Nance is walking around with that hairstyle the whole time.
The whole time.
And there was this, and there was House Party, which hadn't happened yet. So he was like...
he was an innovator.
those are the only roles he could hope to fill.
David Lynch, even at the time, was delivering papers for the Wall Street Journal. And he'd have to deliver at night, like while they were normally filming. And this, he would leave to go deliver it just so he could make a little bit of money and do a route that would normally take 3 or 4 hours. And he'd be back in like 1 hour and 10 minutes. And has done with his route. And it was a strain on him, though. Like, him and his wife split up about 1 year into filming. He ended up living in those stables. Like, Henry's bedroom in the film, David Lynch slept in that bedroom at night, which was completely illegal because he was essentially squatting. But it just shows kind of his commitment and the whole crew's commitment to getting this film done.
It's insane that this, yeah, it's like fate that this movie got made. And I can't even imagine somebody going through all the bullshit getting this movie made nowadays. Part of me thinks that it might be that there was some extra help that they got. Like he knew something no one else did, like that he had the support of the alien race that donated this baby to him.
Possibly. We'll get into that baby. David Lynch also, he was, I was reading an interview with him today, and he was also in a position where he was getting essentially a monthly allowance from his father just to, so he could pay rent. Wasn't paying for the film, but at least he could eat and, you know, eventually not have to sleep in that bedroom any longer on the set. The film finally got done, finally got finished. They went through two cinematographers. The first cinematographer, Herb Cardwell, ended up leaving because essentially he just needed to make more money, and he got a job on a commercial. Later, he actually ended up dying in his sleep at the age of 35. They did an autopsy, were not able to determine what killed him. He just...
Aliens.
Possibly. But they ended up replacing him with Frederick Elms, who later on went to work with David Lynch a couple more times on a couple other films. The cinematography in this film, it's a big part of what makes it work. The fact that they're filming in black and white, which at the time they didn't need to do, although black and white film is typically cheaper. The cast tells stories that there were times when they literally ran out of film and didn't have the money to buy more. And David Lynch was ready to give up and stop making the movie at all. And people would come to set, and they would, like, it sort of became a thing where on their way to work, they would stop by Kodak and grab a roll of film and donate it to the filmmaking. So they were spending money to be in this film. So the movie eventually came out, as I mentioned, in 1977 of March. 25 people or so attended the premiere. So obviously it wasn't a big deal. The next night, second screening, another 24 people. Variety gave it a terrible review. And as did a lot of critics at the time.
Still more people than saw The Last Witch Hunter with Vin Diesel.
I still haven't seen it. A guy named Ben Barinholtz was at one of these screenings, and he's sort of known as the father of the midnight film. He had a few years before this shepherded Jodorowsky's El Topo into sort of cult status. And he sees the movie and immediately wants to buy it. Like, he thinks that he can do something with it. And he persuaded a local theater to run it as a midnight feature, where it continued to play for a year at midnight. And at first, people were not coming to it, and he just kept showing it. And eventually it gathered a kind of a cult following, just because people were seeing the name on the sign all the time. You know, after this, it ran for 99 weeks at New York's Waverly Cinema. It had a year-long midnight run at San Francisco's Roxy Theater from 78 to 79, and ran for 3 years at Los Angeles's New Art Theater from 1978 to 81. And it became a bona fide midnight movie cult phenomenon, just based on Ben Barinholtz's patience and persistence in getting it in front of an audience, which is why I think one reason that it is a worthy film to go into the Psychotronic Hall of Fame, because you could not do that now. I mean, it's the very definition of a cult film. It literally had no audience at first, and it had, the critics didn't even like it. And over time, it's become very popular. And if you read reviews now, it's at 91% on Rotten Tomatoes.
At the very least, you have to respect, like, how much went into the movie, and then patience to, like, make it significant.
Yeah.
I mean, now this is a movie that has a Criterion.
Exactly.
You know.
Exactly. So, sure. Gary, when I nominated this film, and sometimes when I do some of these more offbeat ones, I don't necessarily know where you're going to land. Because our tastes line up a lot of times. That's why we tend to agree more than we disagree on whether a film should go into the Hall of Fame. But occasionally, you'll come and pull a deep red and just completely throw me for a loop. So now honestly, when I do something that's a little more esoteric like this, I don't know where you're going to fall on it.
Right.
So please, let's get into the film itself, and I want to hear some of your thoughts.
I have a lot of thoughts.
Good. Please begin.
Well, I guess it's showing my hand a little if I say it this way. I don't know what this movie does for me, but it does something for me. And that's the weird thing about it. It's a fucked up piece of filmmaking, and I don't understand it, and I don't think that I'm supposed to necessarily.
I think you're absolutely hitting the nail on the head, because I think that one of the things that people bring to this film when they watch it is they're trying to psychoanalyze the film. They're trying to figure out what everything means, because it is so surreal that people are trying to assign meaning to every little thing in the film. But every little thing in the film doesn't have meaning. And David Lynch will be the first person to tell you that he's like, I don't know what it means. Like, it came from my brain and I'm not psychoanalyzing myself. So I can't explain to you what it means because I don't necessarily know what it means to me. And I made the fucking movie.
Yeah.
But what it does create a feeling.
Right.
It feels like a nightmare. I was going to say a waking nightmare, but it feels just like a regular nightmare.
No, that's the only way I could make it make sense in my brain was to think of it as like, this is a dude's nightmare. Like, this is, and actually the way you just said it is the way that I finally reconciled it also is that, if anything, this is an art film. Like, this is someone's brain put on film.
Yeah,
it's,
this is like
super weird.
This is David Lynch's id on screen.
It's just, it's really odd. I don't know. You already mentioned the cinematography. It's really great. The whole tone of the movie is just this, I can't even wrap my head around it, but it's just this weird. And actually, the biggest thing that stood out to me immediately after I watched it was this sound design of the whole movie.
The sound design is one thing that always gets mentioned about this film.
It's uncomfortable.
It is. It makes the entire experience uncomfortable and tense.
I legitimately remembered the dude when I was in high school that told me about it. And so this time when I watched it, turned out all the lights and sat there and watched the thing. And it was just a weird, uncomfortable experience. But the hums and the sounds that just come, like the, when it goes to that fucking dinner and him sitting there with Mary's parents.
Yeah.
And
that suckling.
Yeah, the dogs.
Yeah. Like, what's great, like that thing, that scene, at first you hear that and you don't know where it's coming from.
Right, exactly.
And it's like, I don't know what's more unsettling, the fact that this, they're just having this mundane conversation, small talk, while this sound's going on and nobody's acknowledging it, or the fact that once you see what it is, it's not as like terrifying as you expect it to be. It's just dogs suckling, but the way the sound is so grotesque. It's so,
and he does that too with like her rubbing her eyes or her mouth noises in the bed, and just the fact that there is that. In a lot of scenes, there seems to be this, like, low hum. Or
there's always, there's no silent moment in the film.
Yeah.
Which, and if you view the film as sort of a view into Henry's psyche, which most people tend to do, his mind is never silent. And it gives you a lot of insight into him as a character.
That's interesting.
I'm going to go ahead, I'm going to preface this by sort of repeating what I said earlier, in that I think that to try to analyze the metaphors in this film almost seems counterproductive, because I don't think that there's an exact answer to what it's about. I don't think it's about any one thing. I think that it's a mishmash of ideas that David Lynch had. I think some are more apparent than others, but I think that defeats the point of the film. I think the point of the film is to experience it as a visceral experience. And I think as a visceral experience, it is second to none, and just this feeling of just uneasy dread. With that said, what do you think the movie's about?
I think that the first go-to for probably most people, if they're trying to analyze the film afterwards, is where I landed right at first too, which was fatherhood. This is a guy who's freaked out about having a kid or something. I don't know that I've changed much from that. I just think that I think now I'm more where you are, that there's more than just that going on. I think that is there still.
I think that definitely is there. And that's the most obvious explanation that most people come to. But I do think there's more going on than just that. But that is the clearest sign. I mean, the opening scene,
I was about to say, you could tell.
Conception. That first scene, you literally see a sperm-like figure come out of Henry and go into a hole, a wet hole.
Yeah, and it's coming out of his mouth, which is opposite of most videos I watch. it's obviously, you could go back to that and easily see how that's conception. Back in watching it, what was really neat, too, is that this whole uncomfortable thing of him getting to his apartment, and then like his neighbor, the prostitute or whatever she is, tells him that he's got dinner with his girlfriend, or
Ex-girlfriend.
Yeah, because he's ripped her head off the picture.
By the way, that scene where he's looking at her picture.
Uh-huh.
I didn't notice this until I watched it the most recently, but there's a bowl of water with coins in it in his top drawer, and it's never seen again in the film, but he opens that drawer up, takes a coin, plops it in the water, and then picks up her picture.
I literally have a note here that's like, what the fuck is with that bowl of coins? Like,
I love that. It's so weird.
Because there's stuff like that. There's never... I can't figure out why there's plants with no pots.
Yeah, there's no clear metaphor for, like, what does this mean?
Shit around the radiator and on top of his dresser.
Yeah,
and there's...
And that might not mean anything. It might have just been something that David Lynch saw in a dream and decided to put into his movie.
And fucking
maybe
weird.
He hasn't analyzed his own dream, so why try to analyze the recreation of his dream?
I mean, I was going to talk about how insane all of that is, but, like, last night I dreamt about a homeless guy and his... picking his earwax and offering me a Kit Kat, so I don't really know.
That wasn't a dream, Gary. That happened.
So it's like, if I just put all my shit to film, yeah. I guess it'd be
I could
weird.
Totally see that happening in a David Lynch movie, to be honest.
Right? It sounds like a scene I saw in a David Lynch movie.
So at the time that this was being made, David Lynch was married and had a daughter, and a lot of people kind of try to explain that this is sort of his own fear or his own feelings about his marriage and his daughter, who was an accident. She was unexpectedly conceived, and she was born with, according to David Lynch, severely clubbed feet. So she was deformed and had to have extensive surgery to correct them.
Jesus, I did not know that.
Yeah.
So that feels right. I love that he steps in that puddle, and it's almost like, and it's just like this thing that happens, but it's almost like that puddle was also kind of where the sperm went.
It mirrors that image, yeah.
Yeah, it's just like this accidental, you know, conceiving of a child. I thought that was kind of neat.
Yeah. I mean, several critics and writers have tried to analyze this, and David Lynch has said no writer has ever interpreted the film in exact the same way that he himself interprets the film, which is interesting to me, because that could mean that they're just not getting everything. Also, not that they're not right about anything. But I think the fatherhood and the fear of fatherhood and the fear of marriage, that sort of anxiety over being a father is a huge part of the film.
But
I mean, I don't see how there's any way it's not.
Yeah, yeah. That seems like the obvious part of it.
Because there's this recurring like sperm image motif. Because you've got that at the beginning, but also the baby itself. Later on, the...
Played by a young Admiral Akbar.
So that baby. Let's talk about that baby. All right. Because that baby is fascinating to me. I don't know how they did it. David Lynch has, for 40 years, refused to tell anyone how he made that baby.
It's fucked up, right? Like, how the eyes work.
Because it does... Okay, this is 1977. Same year as Star Wars. Star Wars has animatronics in it that look like animatronics. They look fake. They're great animatronics. This is Lucasfilm. This is ILM at their peak doing stuff that no one else in Hollywood was doing at the time. And you can still tell that it's man-made. But David Lynch making this movie for no money, literally had no money, has somehow created this effect that I cannot look at it and figure out if it's real. It doesn't look animatronic. There have been like rumors that it was a an aborted lamb fetus.
I saw something about
a cow. A calf fetus. But even then, if that's the case, how does he get the eyeballs to move? Mm. How does he get to do the mouth to move and the tongue to come out? I have never been more flabbergasted by an effect in a film and not knowing how it exists.
It's an alien.
Well, that's the thing. Like, he has said, like, when people ask him, he's like, maybe it was already there. Maybe it was born. Maybe it was born nearby. And he will not. Even I was reading a chapter about Eraserhead from Lynch on Lynch today, and the interviewer asked him straight out, how did you do that baby? And he's like, I'm not going to talk about that. That was his only answer, and then they moved on to the next question.
I really feel like there's, like, backup from aliens for this movie. And I don't know. That baby is... It's a fucked up thing to see, and you're right. It's amazing. I was enthralled by its eyes.
Yeah,
like how the eyes
they
worked.
Moved. How do they move?
Yeah, it's
and at the end when the baby gets killed, it spits up blood. And I don't know how they did that.
Well, and they do a really good job with the organs of the baby.
Yeah. You know,
when he cuts.
Those look real.
Yeah.
Like they took real like organs from a butcher shop or something.
Because at first I thought maybe it is a dead calf and they stuffed it full of mashed potatoes.
Those are grits.
They're grits.
Those look like grits.
No, man, it's a fucked up thing, that baby. I really don't understand.
So there have been several writers who have tried to explain the film. David J. Scull, who is a film historian who does a lot of horror movie stuff. Like if you have any of the Universal horror films on Blu-ray or DVD,
right,
there is most likely a commentary by this guy on there. And he's got a great book called The Monster Show, A Cultural History of Horror. And he talks about Eraserhead, and he describes it as depicting human reproduction as a desolate freak show, an occupation fit only for the damned, which is one of my favorite descriptions of this movie because it sort of feels right, you know? Like, it sort of feels like this is Henry's personal hell that he's living in.
Well, you get that kind of, and so that's a good place to bring in the fact that if it is about being scared of fatherhood, he's got this place he goes to in his apartment that he like lays across the bed when he gets home, and Mary's there and the baby, and like he just stares into a radiator, mm-hmm, and it takes him to this place where some fucking weird ass puffy cheeked lady is, yeah, stepping on sperm and singing in heaven.
The lady in the radiator was not originally in the script for the film. It was something that David Lynch thought of. He was on set and he drew a little sketch of the lady in the radiator, didn't know where it came from other than somewhere deep in the recesses of his mind. And then he was kind of looking at the radiator and he's like, this place has a kind of weird radiator. It has this little cavity behind it where it could be a little stage. And he created the lady in the radiator during the filming of the movie. But I think that she is one of the most interesting parts of the film, because I feel like she represents, to me, this is my personal interpretation, I haven't read this anywhere, she sort of like, I think that she is Henry's psyche. Like, that's his dream world that he goes into. I think she's the one sort of urging him to kill the baby at the end. She's not urging him. She is like a manifestation of that urge to kill the baby, I should say. Because at the end, what happens is after he has killed the baby, the very last shot of the film is her smiling at him and embracing him and sort of saying, you did what you were supposed to do.
Yeah, that's weird. No, well, I could totally get that. Because, see, I looked at her as, like, symbolic of, was she hope in some way? That, like, maybe, because I don't really know what's happening there at the end. It almost seems like you could even take it as though he's killed this baby and then himself or something. And I thought, like, there, maybe he's going to heaven.
There is sort of the, like, I thought about that rewatching it today, that could be a murder-suicide at the end.
Yeah.
Because you've also got the man by the window, who is some sort of internal thing with him, because you see him at the beginning of the film. The very first shot of the film is Henry's head superimposed over this planet.
Right.
Which leads me to believe that planet represents Henry's mind, or Henry's being, Henry's consciousness. Because you see it a couple more times throughout the film, and at the very end, the part you're talking about, it explodes.
Yeah, he's just kind of like pulled this lever, and uh-huh, it's like sparking, and he's just like, things are going ape shit or, yeah, something, and it explodes. Yeah.
So you have to wonder if that's like the end of Henry as well.
Because at first I took that as like maybe it was God or something, and his idea of God just like pulling levers or something, and like just shit happens. And
well, I feel like the way that they film that first scene is that they show the planet, they zoom in on the planet very close, and then they kind of go into this building where that man is sitting. Yeah. So I think that he is some sort of mechanical part of Henry's mind. Like, he's something, he's like Henry's consciousness controlling things. Does,
yeah,
that make sense?
No, that makes perfect sense.
And I feel like I'm not wording that well, but I think you get where I'm going.
No, I get exactly what you're saying, because there, I mean, everything about this is like kind of symbolic of like a guy trapped in his own head anyway, mm-hmm, like during this whole thing. I mean, even he sits on the bed and like will look out the window and it's a walled off, like brick walls right outside of his,
right,
window. And I kind of took that as like he's just can't even trapped, see outside, well, of that.
I feel like Henry has spent his entire life feeling trapped and control. Like, he's very inactive. Like even when he goes over to Mary's house, like, he's very passive about everything, all this weird shit going on around. Like, Mary starts to have some sort of like seizure while he's sitting on the couch next to her. He doesn't ignore it. Like, he says, "Oh, I'm sorry," but just sits there and doesn't do anything. And I feel like this is a guy who spent his entire life being passive and just letting things happen around him. And
what about the most uncomfortable dinner scene probably ever filmed?
What do you think that chicken symbolizes?
I don't know.
Other than the fact that I know that David Lynch went vegetarian after making this film, maybe it has something to do with...
Oh, like him, he's just straight out showing, like, this is murder?
Yeah. It's like, is it that? Is he being that obvious?
I don't know. It's super weird.
That chicken is... That black goo that comes out of it has always grossed me out.
Yeah, it's super weird. And the mom has, like, a little freak out there. I don't get the grandma in the kitchen that
she's just, like catatonic and tossing salad.
She tosses the salad around her.
Tossing grandma's salad.
That's what that means. That's how I took it.
I love the dad.
Yeah, he's Bill. He's awesome.
I think it's his name, Bill. Yeah. When he's describing those chickens, little damn things, as big as my fist, small damn things.
They're man-made.
But they're new.
And he's like showing him his knees or something. And then like he also talks about his dead arm.
He's my favorite character. I love that guy. I love his face.
I was about to say his fucking face when he's just sitting there. And I don't know why the mom starts making out with Henry, like, or trying to. And I don't get that.
It's a very uncomfortable family dynamic, whatever's going on. And again, we could try to analyze those things, but I honestly have no fucking clue.
I wondered at some point if the movie was like, I didn't notice this until I was like skimming through it the second time, but like there's a framed picture in one scene in Henry's apartment.
Is it an atom bomb?
Yeah, it's like a mushroom cloud. Yeah.
I noticed that today watching it. I'd never noticed that before. Yeah. And I was like, does he have a framed picture of a mushroom cloud in his room?
And I'm like, is this like a really nihilistic like kind of thing? Like he's just...
I would definitely say this movie is nihilistic.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, obviously there, but I'm just like, is Henry the whole time just fucking fuck the world, everything's shit? I don't know.
So, we try to talk about all this different symbolism and stuff, but as we mentioned before, like, what, I think trying to interpret what these, this is a dream. This whole movie operates on dream logic. Nothing makes sense, and it's not supposed to make sense. And I think trying to analyze that dream logic is about as pointless as trying to actually analyze your actual dreams. You know, people try to analyze dreams, but it's a pseudoscience at best.
What do you think it means that, and not to take you off subject where you're going, but kind of there too, like if this is a dream and this is like David Lynch's dream. The one thing that drove me nuts about this movie is that like there's none of those characters are really likable people.
They're really not.
Even Henry, who the movie is modeled after, is not great.
No, because he's so passive and so... I mean, he hates his child. He murders his child.
Right.
He's not someone that you want to...
He cheats on his wife with the neighbor across the hall. He's just a weirdo in general.
How about that scene where they go to bed and it's turned into a jacuzzi full of milk?
You know, by that point, I was just kind of like, yeah. that seems right.
On that Blu-ray, there's a documentary. David Lynch is talking about that scene. Catherine Coulson's asking him about it. And she's like, what did you fill that with? Like, what was that like milk-like substance? He's like, you know, it was milk. She's like, oh, okay.
Yeah. I had not really watched this movie as a whole for a very, very long time. So it took me a little while to get into it, like to be ready for where my brain needed to be to watch this movie. And it's definitely the first kind of movie that we've watched like this for this show. But what is he like as a person? Like, do you think he's a... Because I love Mulholland Drive, for instance. Like, I think that's a movie that we should talk about one day. Okay. But
that's my favorite. Yes.
Yeah, Mulholland Drive is awesome. But that, or Twin Peaks, or anything else I can think of by him, is more coherent as a story for the most part, except, like, I mean, this one doesn't even, I mean, there is a story.
Yeah, well, but I think what's interesting about this film is that for the first part of the film, if you were to, like, try to write down the plot, it would be pretty apparent. Like, it's a pretty straightforward plot. It's,
yeah.
There's some weird things going on, but it's a guy has broken up with his girlfriend, or they've broken up. He gets invited over to her home for dinner with her family, where he finds out that he has impregnated her and she's had a child. And then the movie's about him, you know, them trying to deal with the fact that they now have a child together and his fears about fatherhood. And this sounds very straightforward. Of course, then it gets into this extended dream sequence towards the end where things just go off the rails.
Right.
But it's a matter of not necessarily what the movie's about, what is happening on screen, but how the story is being told. And I think that's one reason that this film, as opposed to other like art films and experimental films, holds up, has reached a wider audience than some, is because it is actually, despite its weirdness, it's easy to follow. You don't at any point, you might go, what the fuck is going on? But you're never really lost as to what your character is doing. The way the story is being told is weird, but what is actually happening is there's a story there.
You know what's kind of cool about it, too? You saying that made me think of, it's kind of neat that the movie is also going to be pretty timeless in a way that, like, it... Because you don't know when this is supposed to be taking place.
Or where.
I mean, they shot
the film in California, but it certainly doesn't look like California.
It's like this industrial area, but it's like could be futuristic, like wasteland. Yeah, it could be
post-apocalyptic. Maybe that's why he documented the mushroom cloud on his wall.
Right. That's a good point. Yeah, I don't know. It's kind of interesting. I just wonder... Like, what David Lynch is, do you think he's like trying to be weird?
Or I think like I honestly don't think he's, like, making a conscious effort to be, like, I'm going to be as weird as possible and just throw weird shit up on the screen. I think that he is legitimately and I'm basing this based on books I've read where he's been interviewed and watching him in interviews about his stuff and listening to him talk about his films and his art. I think he comes by it honestly. I think he is one of those people whose brain is just wired differently. And I think that he is so uncompromising about his art that he's willing to put the weird stuff on screen without trying to give you an explanation for it.
Right. I wonder if he would be... So when I was listening to the In Heaven song, I was thinking to myself, I was like, God, the soundtrack to this movie is so fucked up. This is like a Billy Corgan wet dream, like right here. This
it's a lot of just like ambient noise and Fats Waller playing an organ.
Right. And I was like, I bet Justin has the soundtrack to this movie.
I have pre-ordered it. It is being repressed in June on vinyl. And I listened to it yesterday while I was writing up my notes, and it's literally, even the soundtrack itself is just, it's two tracks. It's side A and side B, and they're like 20 minutes long a piece, and then the In Heaven song, but it's just weird soundscapes.
And I was thinking to myself, I wonder if David Lynch would like what he thinks of people. I mean, I guess he's okay there being a soundtrack, but I'm like, would he be weirded out that you want to listen to that shit? Because he's like, this is my goddamn nightmare.
Yeah. Well, listen, he's a guy who, in the recent years, he has gotten more into... He's been making more music than he has movies in the last decade. And a lot of his stuff has that weird soundscape sound to it. But, I mean, it also has lyrics and actual instruments and stuff. But I think the sound is a very big part of this film. We mentioned this early on in the show, but David Lynch and Alan Splett, who was the sound designer on this, worked for a solid year after filming commenced on the sound for this film. David Lynch films in general tend to have a pretty unique soundscape to them. Like, sound is a big part of the art that he makes. Like that short film I mentioned, that Six Men Getting Sick, would not be as affecting as it is if that loud siren wasn't playing over it the whole time.
So let me ask you a question then I have. While I was watching this, and as weird as it is and that sort of thing, where's the line for somebody like, for like a Lars von Trier movie or something that's also very weird and atmospheric and like, or where's the line? I say Lars von Trier, he just came to mind, but for anybody that like, that's throwing shit on film.
Well, I think that a part of it is what, based on the question you asked earlier, is he trying to be weird? I don't think he is. And I think that's why his stuff endures more than some other art film makers do. because I think that he is not at all trying to be pretentious. He's just being David Lynch, and that's just, it just happens to be that David Lynch is, that's just who he is. Where someone like, for instance, Lars von Trier, I think is trying desperately to be pretentious and to make films that are considered important. I think the fact that David Lynch is never aspired to be a filmmaker is a big part of that, because he's not trying to make films as much as he's trying to make art. This is an extension of his, it started out as an extension of his painting career, and I think this is just a continuation of his artistic career, and he just happens to have found a different medium that for some bizarre reason has struck a nerve with the national consciousness. Like the fact that David Lynch went on to make a show that aired on national television is one of the most bizarre stories to come out of Hollywood.
You would have never guessed that.
Yeah. Like he's... I mean, this film, you know, based on it, its midnight movie career for several years, it became a big deal in Hollywood. Like Stanley Kubrick considered this his favorite film. And Stanley Kubrick, when they were going The Shining, they were going to film The Shining, he would say, he made the entire cast and crew watch it, saying, this is how you make a horror film.
It's super weird that you say that. Like, I had read that, and at one point, it's amazing to me, like, how much this movie has evolved in my mind just since last night watching it. That is definitely one thing that happens in The Shining, too, is, like, this, the way it makes you feel when you watch it.
Yeah.
It's, like, it's super important.
And
to
just
the whole
like
thing.
In both of those films, a large part of that is the sound design, too.
Right, right.
And I think both of them utilize dream logic a lot.
At another point
so,
in my
so
life,
much of The Shining is taking place inside of Jack Torrance's mind.
If you'd have told me like 2 weeks ago, I'd have been like, I don't think I understand what you're talking about. But then now I can kind of see that. Like, it's pretty interesting.
This movie was, Mel Brooks was a big fan of it. Mel Brooks went on to produce The Elephant Man and hired David Lynch to do The Elephant Man based on this film.
Yeah. And you can see, like, Blazing Saddles takes a lot from it.
George Lucas, actually, after watching this film, asked David Lynch to direct Return of the Jedi, which, Jesus Christ, can I live in an episode of Sliders where I go to an alternate dimension where there is a version of Return of the Jedi that exists as directed by David Lynch?
I cannot fathom what that is.
But I want to see it.
And if you were picking one of the Star Wars movies, you'd go, like, Empire, right? Like,
no, I want to see David Lynch's version of the Ewoks. I want to see that. I want to see that happen.
That's so fucked up. Now, granted, there should be a Star Wars film, at least one of these spinoffs or something that's directed by David Lynch.
God, please,
just something.
It's a remake of the Ewok Adventures.
Oh my God.
Anyway, getting back to the movie, like I think that I mean. It clearly has a legacy. These filmmakers they were affected by it for some reason. And I think that a big part of it is because it is an uncompromising vision by a clear artist, but it has enough storytelling points. This is kind of based on what we were talking earlier. There's enough storytelling points to give viewers something to kind of hang on to, the more straightforward stuff at the beginning, so that they're fully immersed in the experience by time you get into Henry's weird dream sequence where his head falls off and gets turned into an eraser. Hence the name of the movie. And I will tell you, out of all the analyzing of this film, I have no fucking clue.
I was about to ask that. I was like, after everything.
I have tried and I have no idea.
I don't get that.
And I have not read a single other writer or critic who has explained that scene. No, it's like they don't even mention it.
They just ignore it. The whole movie is named after this scene.
And nobody knows what it means.
It's just like, all right, well.
I have no idea.
So here's the thing. For me, and then I'll let you go, I guess, is like I want to say that I wanted to have a deep red moment with you and be like, what the fuck, Justin? No, let's be reasonable. I'm a rational man. This movie is bullshit. But it's not bullshit. It really isn't bullshit. And you can't put yourself in that environment and watch it and tell me you don't feel anything about it. Even if you hate it, like it's still, and like I said at the beginning of this episode, I don't know what I feel about it. I just don't know. But I think any film that does that and makes you think about it, I've been thinking about it since, and skimmed back through it again just because I'm like, what's happening? You know, like, I think any movie that does that is worth something. I also love about David Lynch that anything I tried to, and my research is not as in-depth as yours, but like anything I tried to dig up on him talking about it, as he seemed very much like, whatever you interpret, then fine.
And he's about that, like all of his films. He wants you to read into it however you read into it.
And I think maybe that's kind of neat.
You know, and that also, it allows the audience to get a sort of a insight into their own psyche, because they might be projecting things on it. Right. And if he's telling you what it's about, then you're not projecting any of your own stuff on it. And you get a lesser experience.
And nothing feels random in it. You
no,
know?
No, like, that's the thing, is that even when you don't know what the fuck is happening in the film, you never at any moment feel like Lynch is making it up as he goes.
Yeah, just like throwing something on there for the hell of it.
He knows, you might not know what exactly he's trying to say, but you get the sense that he knows what he's saying.
Yeah, you're more inclined to be like, it's not like the Tim and Eric show. I mean, and even them, like, they seem like they'd get along with David Lynch. But
I want to see that collaboration.
But, you know, there's not like some kind of random bit of something just like thrown at the wall here, right, like the sperm. It's
which, by the way, that scene is, what is he doing? Is he jerking off? Is that a scene of him jerking off? Because he's like, his wife's next to him.
It didn't hit me until, like, literally till right then when I said that. I was, and you said, what is he?
Because he's like, his hands are, he's reaching under the covers while he's in bed next to his wife.
And he's just pulling out.
And just pulling them out and throwing them against the wall.
I think he is.
Or is that his way of like, I'm going to jerk off so that I don't have any more of these crazy demon babies.
Yeah.
Because I'm not going
to. You get the impression he hasn't gotten laid much since the weird alien baby.
Well, he tries to touch her and she twitches.
Yeah, she like pulls away from him. And so, like, maybe he just...
I think that's him jerking off.
I think it is. God damn it. Just the more you talk about it, the more... it's weird to me that the fucking bandages are the only thing holding that baby together.
Yeah.
And, like, that whole thing. I don't know. I don't... whatever.
So, Gary, I guess let's get your final. I know you've already kind of started on it, but let's get your final verdict on: do you think this is a film worthy of the Psychotronic Hall of Fame?
Yeah, I do. Thought that I would, like I was going to say before, I thought that I was going to have a deep red moment with you and have to be like, I get it. A lot of people think this is classic, but blah blah blah. I don't think that with this. I mean, like I said, I don't know what to think about this movie entirely. But I think something of this movie.
It brings up feelings in you.
Yeah, it's there's something happening here, and it's, if I had to think of a movie that I would call an art film, this seems like it would be it. Like, there is something that is art about how this film is done, from the way it looks, the way it sounds, and what happens. It's all meaningful. And like we were just saying, nothing in it ever seems like something thrown up against the wall just to see what sticks, like the sperm. It's all, it feels like there's a purpose. And you're never like questioning like, oh, he was just seeing what he could get away with. You're just like, I wonder what he was thinking in that entire moment. You know, like, what was happening? That's a cool thing for a movie to do. Mm-hmm. And you know, sure, it's no fucking Rambo movie or something, but
it's no Fast and Furious 8.
Exactly, it's no Fast and Furious 8. But if, you know, maybe you don't always want to think so deeply, but if a movie like insists that you do, you can't argue with that. That's pretty impressive. And so, yeah, I think this movie definitely deserves a spot.
Cool. Well, I obviously agree. I nominated this film for a reason. It is one of I think, the most important films that we've nominated for the Hall of Fame so far, because I think that it is, one, it signaled the beginning of a filmmaking career from David Lynch, who I don't think this is hyperbole.
This is Justin jerking him off.
It is. I think David Lynch is one of the most important artists of the 20th and 21st century. I think he is more than you can say about almost any other filmmaker, is just a true artist. He transcends just the term filmmaking, because there's something more going on with David Lynch movies that you don't get from literally any other filmmaker. You can put any of his films on screen and immediately identify it. And this is, it's not my favorite David Lynch film, but I think that it is the one David Lynch film that is most pure in its, it is the most purely David Lynch film to hit screen. Like there's been no desaturation of it. It is like his psyche. It's his id on screen. It hasn't been affected by, you know, his later films. He was making stuff in Hollywood and making great films. I mean, I love Blue Velvet. I love Wild at Heart. This is the one that is most purely unfiltered David Lynch. And I think that's important because it signals what he's to do later on.
It's like Brett Ratner level awesomeness, right?
Almost like Rush Hour 2. It's very close. But I think that, you know, analyzing the film is fun. It's part of the fun of watching the film, but I think that part of what makes the film great is that it cannot be fully analyzed. You know, there are certain elements that you can point out and say this means this and this means that, but then you see things like the coins in the water and the chicken, and it's like, what does any of this symbolize? I don't know. And I read one critic talking about trying to explain the film. He said, to explain Eraserhead would be like cutting a drum open to see what makes noise. You may get your answer, but you tend to ruin the drum in the process. And I think that's a pretty great way to look at this film, because right. I think trying to analyze it too much takes away the fun of the film. If you could call this film fun.
Yeah.
It's fun to me as like a movie nerd, but it's fascinating.
I think it's going to be lost on a lot of people still. Yep. I really do think that, but I think if you give it a legit chance, like you...
Well, I also think it deserves to be in the Hall of Fame just based on its, like, the very definition of what a psychotronic film is. Like, this movie is one of the films that... it is one of the films that sort of started the midnight movie movement, which does not exist now and could not exist now. Like, this movie could not exist now. There's not any sort of distributor that would probably even buy this film at all these days. But if they did, they certainly wouldn't have the patience to let it play for a year playing midnights at a single theater, hoping that it would find an audience.
This movie would be on YouTube or on a random Roku channel.
Right, yeah. It'd be on like B Action Cinema. And I'd have to watch 17 commercials during the course of it.
Right.
But, you know, also upon its release, like it was, I mean, it is a, you know, when we talk about, when we describe psychotronic films, we talk about them being cult films. This is a cult film, if there ever was one, because it has built quite a cult fan base.
Right.
And that cult fan base has basically given David Lynch a filmmaking career. And in fact, there's a book called Midnight Movies that's all about that whole movement. And guess what is the cover of the book?
Eraserhead.
It's fucking Henry. Henry. It's that iconic image of Henry from Eraserhead. And that's for a reason. And, you know, it's also when we describe psychotronic films, we talk about films that were critically ignored. Well, I've got some quotes from some early reviews from Eraserhead. Variety called it a sickening bad taste exercise. Tom Buckley of the New York Times called it murkily pretentious.
Oh, we didn't even have to go to Amazon one star.
No, these are great. Yeah, The Atlantic said it was one of the most unalloyed surrealist he called David Lynch one of the most unalloyed surrealists to ever work in the movies. So, and that was in 1984. So eventually people started, like, as it played for years and years, people started going, this guy, there's something about this guy. And like I mentioned before, it is now 91% on Rotten Tomatoes. Like, it is almost universally lauded as an important film.
It's super weird, though, because those people had a chance to see it dark in a dark theater, like, to sit there in front of it. I don't know how you watch it in that kind of environment. Like, I would love to sit in the theater and see this movie, because I think that, if anything, I could see somebody just going insane because they watched this movie in a dark theater. Yeah. Like, they're just like, what happened? I don't know.
I would love to see this film on the big screen one day. I've never had a chance to do so. But I think that I think there's no way that you don't vote this into the Hall of Fame, because it is, and I've said this before, I think I said it on Deep Red, that it is like a definition of what a psychotronic film is. But this one, even more so than I think any other film that we've talked about, is the very definition of what we're looking for in this Hall of Fame. And we do movies like, you know, Pacific Rim, which we did recently, which was a big blockbuster, but still kind of fit into that same mindset. But this is the most pure form of the type of movies that we're talking about here.
Right.
And so I don't think there's any way that – I don't see how anyone can vote against it just based on historical merit and the fact that it signaled the beginning of the career of David Lynch, one of the most popular now cult filmmakers that we have, you know.
Yeah, I'm with you 100% on that. I think David Lynch deserves a spot, and this movie is definitely, if you're into the kind of movies that we talk about on here and where we're apt to go eventually, this is a must-see.
Yeah, give it a chance. Like, you know, watch it as it's supposed to be watched. Like, don't try to figure it out. Just experience it. That's the way you're supposed to watch this film, is you're just supposed to sit there. Like Gary said, his friend told him, you know, the first time he watched it, just sit there with the lights off and the sound turned up loud and experience the film. And then gather your thoughts afterwards. But.
And even then, you're still probably.
You're not going to figure it out.
Yeah. It's not.
But you won't be able to deny its power. As a viewing experience.
It does something, for sure.
So, guess what? You guys get to vote on whether or not this belongs in the Psychotronic Hall of Fame. Me and Gary have both made our cases that we both very much think you should vote yes on this. So, hit us up on Twitter at Psychotronic Pod. We'll have a pinned tweet at the top. We'll also have a pinned post at the top of our Facebook page at Psychotronic Pod. And you can also find a link in our iTunes description. It'll also be in the description of whatever podcast listener app thingy that you like.
And check out the Dead Kennedys song Too Drunk to Fuck.
Okay.
Because
they mentioned this?
Yeah. Oh. They mentioned the song. They say, like, you whine more than the baby in Eraserhead. Oh. And it never really registered with me.
There's also a cover of In Heaven by the Pixies, which we listened to right before we started recording this. So if you want to hear that. And, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, subscribe, rate, and review on iTunes. Gary, where can you be found on the internet?
I'm at Rock and Roll Gary.
And I'm at Justin _ Bishop. Gary, what are we talking about next week?
I cannot tell you how excited I am to talk to you about this.
Well, I'm glad you're sitting behind that table.
Okay, so next week, I feel like we're on a roll here with something that we need to continue with. And next week, when we're going to be recording.
Eraserhead
2. Yeah.
Electric Boogaloo.
That's it. But it is going to be Mother's Day.
Oh. Are we watching Mother's Day?
No, we're not watching Mother's Day. And you know what would be the obvious one I would have gone with Mother's on a Day? Normal day? No, not Mother's Day, because I haven't seen that in forever, and I don't know if it's worthy of anything. But I was, up until last night, gonna pick Friday the 13th because
the mom thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
spoiler. But instead, I've been inspired.
All right,
and you might have thought at some point during this episode I was talking about randomness and just asking general questions, but I'm real curious, and I think we could be missing the boat on something, and I want to find out. Let's stay where we're at right now in the same mindset, and I want us next week to talk about, well, parenting is tough. And as Eraserhead pointed out to us, what if we also talked about a similar movie? We'll see. I want to talk about Antichrist.
Oh, fuck.
I'm going to nominate Lars von Trier's. I'm going to nominate Lars von Trier's Antichrist for the Psychotronic Hall of Fame.
This will be the third goddamn time I've watched this movie.
And I was super excited because of you. Because
you know how much I hate that movie.
And I was watching Eraserhead and thinking about Antichrist.
Fuck.
And so I'm going to do it. I'm going to fucking do it. It's a horror movie, I guess. And
it's definitely a psychotronic film, I guess.
It's a psychotronic film. Next week, we're talking about Antichrist.
I'm going to need several beers. Several. I might drink a whole bottle of bourbon while watching the movie.
It's going to be a good one, folks.
Is it easy to find streaming?
It's everywhere. It's
Netflix?
It's on Netflix. It's on Hulu. It's on Shudder if you have a subscription.
I do.
Yep. It's there. And you can rent it and stream it from where God all your regular sources.
Can't believe I got to watch that movie again this week.
So, guys, get ready. We're going to watch Antichrist. I'm actually going to try to go into it in a positive view.
I'm going to try to be open-minded, but I've seen it.
Let's put David Lynch right up in front of Lars von Trier, and let's see what happens.
All right, guys. Well, we'll see you next week. Go watch Antichrist.
Your voice almost gave out just saying it. Telling people to go watch Antichrist.
All right. Until then.
May the wings of liberty never lose a feather.
All right. Here's the swimming with bow-legged women.
You sound so beat.
Slice of fried gold.